everyone. Well, welcome to Stutter Talk episode 580, starting off with some good voluntary stuttering. We're going to try to get this published May 23rd, 2016. I'm your host, Peter Reitis, here in Carrboro, North Carolina, late Sunday night, and we are joined via Skype by Dr. Michelle Swift in South Adelaide, Australia. Hey, Dr. Swift.
Good morning. It's morning here.
Yeah, it's good morning there. It's getting late here, but it is all good. Dr. Michelle Swift is a lecturer and clinical educator in fluency disorders for the Flinders University Speech Pathology Program in Adelaide, South Australia. Dr. Swift is co-author of the new and much-discussed study, Case File Audit of Lidcombe Program Outcomes in a Student-Led Stuttering Clinic, and that's going to be our big topic today. And the study is published in the International Journal of Speech Language Pathology. Many links are going to be up at stuttertalk.com at episode 580. And Dr. Swift, you already taught me something. Here in the States, we say Rice Krispies. And what's the term in Australia?
We call them rice bubbles.
Rice bubbles. So for a sound check, I'll let the listeners know that I ask our guests what they had for breakfast, and I was stumped by rice bubbles. So that's awesome. And I'll let folks know that Australia is Stutter Talk's fourth largest market behind the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada. So I want to say hello to all of our listeners and friends in Australia. So Dr. Swift, your study is being talked about a lot, and it looks at children who received Lidcombe program treatment by students. In the States, we would call them graduate students. So what I'm going to do is really over-summarize Lidcombe just to let the listeners know, and we've discussed this treatment a lot on Stutter Talk, and there'll be links up for much more information. So I'm going to over-summarize it. And then I hope you will add what you want to add or clarify anything. So
sure.
Great. Lidcombe is a parent-administered preschool stuttering treatment based on operant conditioning. It's also used with some older children as well. But for today's purposes, we focus on preschool stuttering. Parents are trained to administer verbal contingencies. So for example, non-stuttered speech is rewarded with phrases such as, "That was nice smooth talking." And stuttered speech is gently corrected with phrases such as, "That was bumpy, try it again." The Lidcombe program has two stages. In stage one, parents keep daily data regarding their child's stuttering severity, and they meet with the clinician about once a week to review the work. Stage two is maintenance, in which once the stuttering level is consistently kept very low, the clinician begins reducing how often they meet with the family. And again, we're going to link to past discussions and to a lot of information about Lidcombe. Is there anything you'd like to add to that general summary of the treatment?
I guess just that during stage one, the parents do home practice with their children. They do it daily for 10 to 15 minutes. And during that time, they're structuring conversations to reduce the level of stuttering that the child has, so that the verbal contingencies can be overwhelmingly positive during that time. That would be my only addition, really.
Yeah, and sometimes here in the States, or my friends on Stutter Talk, we'll talk about that parent-led homework as special talking time or something like that. I know that I work with parents who love their special talking time. I'm going to summarize your study for you, that of course you can add as much as you want, and I have a ton of questions prepared to ask you. So your team reported on the case files of 49 children between 2 years old and 5 years, 11 months, who received Lidcombe program stuttering treatment in a student-run clinic. So here are two of your team's findings, and we're going to discuss all the nuts and bolts of this in just a minute. So finding one, quote, "This study demonstrates that students can achieve the same short-term treatment outcomes for children who stutter using the Lidcombe program as those reported in the current published literature." And finding two, quote, "The the client dropout rate in our study was 57% for clients who exited treatment without completing stage one, and even higher at 63% for those clients who discontinued prior to finishing stage two, end quote. And as I pass it over to you, that second piece is what's drawing a lot of people's attention, because it looks like a small majority of the families in your study, the parents pulled their children out of speech therapy before completing the work. So tell us in your own words, like, what were your big findings? Did anything surprise you? Take it wherever you will before I start to throw some questions at you.
Sure. Well, our purpose of our study, I guess, was to benchmark our outcomes from our student-led clinic to the literature. And we focused on Lincoln program because there's a lot of literature around to benchmark. We had five research questions, which you have summarized two of them. And I guess we looked at what was the reduction in stuttering severity and found that we were able to achieve a reduction from a pretreatment mean of 4.6% SS to an end of stage one mean of 0.4% SS, which is comparable to the published literature, and it was statistically significant and had a large effect size. One of the things that we were particularly interested in was the median number of clinic sessions to complete stage one, and we found that student-led clients took a median of 19 clinic sessions to complete stage one, and this was longer duration than in the published literature. So to us, that was one of the key findings. We found that our clinical factors associated with treatment duration were exactly the same as in all the published literature. So basically that initial severity predicted treatment duration, but not age, and also in ours, not onset to treatment duration. And then we did have the withdrawal, which was something we were interested in looking at to just know how many clients were completing treatment through this clinic. And as you said, we had 57% of clients did not complete stage one. And overall, their stuttering didn't reduce very much, although those that stayed in for longer than 11 sessions did reduce their stuttering, their percent SS by over half during that time.
It's such an interesting study. So for those who did complete stage one, I think you just said it took 19 sessions. So in the previous published literature, wasn't it closer to like 12 or 14 sessions or 11 sessions to get through stage one?
It depends. So some the previous case file audit literature is reporting about 11 sessions, although two of those studies were before the criteria to enter stage two was changed to require you to keep that criteria for three consecutive weeks. So previously that wasn't a criteria. So you might meet the criteria and then you'd go to stage two, whereas now you have to keep that criteria consistently over a period of 3 weeks, so that increases the time. So in some of the more recent prospective studies, we're finding around 15 and occasionally up to 18 sessions being the median, but certainly 19 was at the higher end. It was outside of that range, and I guess if you consider the whole range as being like sort of look at what the average is on that range, then it's probably at around 13, 14 sessions. And so, yes, it was higher. It was a lot higher than what has been previously published. So that was of interest to us as our student clinic is one of the main service providers for stuttering in the state due to the what is and isn't seen by speech language pathologists in the public sector here.
And I think I read in your study that at least two of the three main supervisors at the clinic are highly trained in LIDCOM. Did I get that right?
Yes. So two of us, myself being one of them, have received a, have done LIDCOM program training and have a lot of experience doing it. Although one of them, one of the other CEs for whom, clinical educator, for whom that is the case, when she started out, didn't have a lot of experience, and that was during the time that this audit was carried out. So her level of experience with the program itself has increased over the time that we audited. So at the very beginning, when she was just starting out, her level of experience with the program wasn't high, but by the end it would have been quite substantially improved. Yep.
So as I mentioned a few moments ago, the 57% dropout rate has caught a lot of people's attention here in the States. And I'll just speak from the first thing I thought was, wow, that's really high. So did that strike you as being much higher than you expected? And what explanation do you have for such a high dropout rate?
Well, we think that probably the main explanation is actually the clinic structure. And so I guess in some ways we didn't see it as being hugely high, although because everybody's been saying that's very, very high, I've been thinking about it and saying, well, maybe it is. The clinic structure means that almost all the clients have at least one change in student clinician, and they also have gaps in service of up to 6 weeks in treatment over the semester breaks, which impacts on continuity of service. And from our clinical experience in the clinic, would say that it's at the second change of, or sometimes even the first change of student clinician, that the families choose not to continue. So they've had an enforced break on them, so they kind of get out of the habit, I guess, of coming to the clinic. But also they have to rebuild the therapeutic relationship with the next lot of students. And sometimes they say, I just don't want to go through that again. And I would say that that's not necessarily just, I mean, it's part of the issue of having a student clinic and having students rotating through. But when I used to work in country, South Australia, we used to have a very similar issue. A lot of people were coming through on 3-month contracts, so they would come, stay for 3 months, and they would leave again. And a lot of clients would decide not to continue with treatment because they didn't want the change in clinician. So we think that that's one of the main issues. Also, with the LICM program itself, it doesn't have a set duration, so that can potentially impact on motivation, whereas if you're doing a program like an intensive stuttering treatment or something like that that lasts for 3 weeks plus follow-up, then there's a very set period of time that the clients are coming in for, whereas with the LICM program, it goes until a certain criteria is met, but you don't know how long that's going to be. And we know that students take longer. From this study, we found that students take longer to get clients down to that point, so that might impact on the motivation to stay. Also, in terms of with 4 of our families, they did withdraw because they were happy with the current gains, but because they didn't actually meet the LICM program criteria for entering stage 2, then they count as dropouts. Whereas if they had been doing a different program, like my understanding of the DCM therapy or Palin parent-child interaction therapy, is that treatment is finished at the point that the clinician and the family are happy with the gains. So for those families, for those treatments, they wouldn't count as dropouts, but they do in LICM. And because we're a student clinic, we're very strict on you need to actually meet the criteria before you move them on, because we want to teach the students to do the program the way that it was developed. And obviously that isn't always the way that it's actually done out in community clinics, where there are lots of other pressures in terms of getting people through in a certain period of time.
You know, also, I think that, okay, just jump in real quick. That's a really good point, because the last 2 preschoolers I worked with, I think each one of them had 11 sessions. Maybe one of them had 12, but they were both around 11 sessions, and the stuttering was brought way down, and the families were done. They're like, thanks, we're done. Yep. You know, I'm like, well, could we just exit you? Oh, we'll do the exit on the phone, you know? So, yep. Yeah. So, and I didn't see that in your paper. So I think that's a great point to get out on the air, that a few of the families, think you just had four with Drew because they were pleased.
Yes, so that is in there. I think it's in the results section rather than the discussion about
the reasons. Yeah.
No, that's fine. Because we didn't talk a lot in the discussion about the dropout rate, because for us the most important finding or the most interesting finding was around the length of treatment. But so, yeah. And I guess it's possibly because of our knowledge of the clinic and the structure that it, I mean, it did strike us. We were like, okay, this is a bit too many. We would prefer to have a few less, because if they are leaving before they're finished, what does that potentially mean for long-term outcomes? So we did highlight in it, and we do discuss that, but in terms of the actual number being very high, yeah, we didn't sort of dawn on us, I guess, that it was quite so much higher than other studies, which looked into more now, and that is the case. One other thing that I was going to point out is that just over the period that we audited, the clinic was actually changing days from a Wednesday to a Thursday every semester due to clinical educator availability, and this actually prevented some clients from continuing because they couldn't make the change day, and then some other clients just got fed up with that, which is fair enough as well. So it has more recently been on a consistent day, but it was changing all the time.
Yeah, that stuff really does happen. I mean, I have a family that only wants to come in on Thursdays. And if something happens on a Thursday, like school is closed or something, this is a family that comes in to my school for services, then they just don't come that week. And I'll offer them every other day, but they won't come. So those are great points. This is Stutter Talk. Our guest today is Dr. Michelle Swift, a lecturer and clinical educator in fluency disorders for the Flinders University Speech Pathology Program in Adelaide, South Australia. Am I saying that right? Is it Adelaide?
It's Adelaide, yeah.
Great.
That's correct.
So a bunch of questions were sent to me by friends of the show and by Stutter Talk Advisor. So here is a question that I got from several different people. Is it possible that the success of Lidcombe is based on the expert clinicians and not the actual program?
Well, I don't think that's entirely the case, because our students were able to make the same progress in terms of treatment success. It just took them longer. I think there is evidence, so for the Arnott and colleagues group Lidcombe study, they reported a learning curve with a new treatment. So in that study, the main clinician, she found that over the course of the study, it was taking her fewer sessions to complete stage one as she became more familiar and experienced with the group version of the treatment. And that wasn't the case with individual for which she was very experienced. So we would be expecting students to take longer because it's a new treatment for them, and so you'd have that learning curve for every new set of students. I think we do know, though, that there is evidence in psychology that the actual treatment only accounts for maybe around 30 to 70% of change, and the rest is clinician factors. So I'd say, again, that that's likely why parents are dropping out of treatment after a second student change, because they're having to build the therapeutic alliance for the third time. And obviously the longer the treatment takes, the greater chance of having multiple student changes. So if you've got students who are already taking longer, then you're going to have that being more likely. So I don't think that it is just that it is that previous studies have used more expert clinicians. I think that the program itself does reduce stuttering, but certainly there is always going to be an interaction between the program and the expertise of the clinician administering it in terms of how quickly that success takes place. So, for example, on a program that I'm not trained in, I would expect it to take families longer to go through, because it's not a program that I have great familiarity with.
And this question just popped into my head, but do you think this also has something to do with student confidence? Because, I mean, in the United States, I think, or I assume, the majority of graduate students are going to be in that 23-year-old age range. And a lot of preschool stuttering treatment is really knowing what you're doing and getting parents to buy into what you're doing so they do it at home, so they become the therapist. And do you think part of this is that it's just hard for students to sort of take charge?
Yes, I think with our students, with the students that we have in the program here, they are fairly junior students in terms of this is either their first or their second clinical placement roster. So we have two programs, that both of which qualify people to be fully qualified speech pathologists in Australia. One is a four-year bachelor degree and the other one is a two-year master's degree. And so students in this clinic would either be in their first or second semester of third year for the bachelor degree. And so those students are reasonably young. They might only be 19. And then we have the first, they'd be in their second semester of first year master's. And those students, obviously, they've already got a bachelor degree, so they're probably a little bit older, maybe 22 and above. And so I think there could be a confidence issue, as you were saying, working with parents, convincing parents that this is a good thing to be doing, to putting aside the extra 10 to 15 minutes each day, because it actually is, it sounds not like very much on paper, but as a parent, it actually can be quite difficult to fit 10 to 15 minutes of something extra in each day. So some of it could be student confidence, some of it also around the fact that our students are earlier on in their clinical skill development, so their clinical reasoning needs more support and they will take longer to make some of those changes compared to, say, a senior student.
Yeah, and I want to give the listeners an example of what I'm thinking of, and I'd love to get your feedback on it. So I'm going to discuss something that came up in preschool stuttering treatment that wasn't Lidcombe or wasn't operant conditioning, but it's something that occurs from time to time in my treatment, and it just occurred recently where a new family came in. The child was almost 4 years old, and I give the child a toy to play with while I talk with the parent. And the child kept interrupting us, kept interrupting mom, and that it seemed very directly led to a lot of stuttering, because the more the child whined and had whiny speech and interrupted, the more they stuttered. And I could very confidently say to mom, tell your child that it's not their turn to talk right now, and you'll give them a turn to talk in a moment and then look back at me. And mom did it, and I could see she was kind of scared. And then I could see she was so relieved when her child went back to play and it worked. And she gave me that look like, I didn't know I could do that. And that's the type of thing that I think would be really hard for a young student to do, to have the confidence to do that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I certainly can remember as a student myself that I didn't like working with children, that I actually preferred working with adults. And part of that was kind of that situation, the idea that you had to control the behaviour and the environment of the child and keep the child interested and talk to the parent at the same time and make clinical decisions. So certainly from my own experience, I can say, yes, I can imagine that students are still having concerns around that sort of thing. It is, once I became fully qualified and I had more experience working with kids, and this was in a generalist position, so it wasn't just in stuttering, but it didn't bother me anymore and I actually really quite enjoyed it. So I think in terms of, yeah, there is a level of confidence in your own skill, but also just in terms of the amount of different things that you have to keep in mind at the one time. And that as a student, when you're actually learning, so you're learning the program, the technique that you're giving, but you're also learning how to talk to clients how to educate parents, how to keep children entertained. So all of those things are all new things that are being learnt, and that's a lot of things to keep in mind all at once. So I think confidence is part of it, but it's also just in terms of cognitive load is another.
Yeah, that's a great point. And just to sort of close out this question is that I love to be able to say a phrase to parents. So I do something that might be hard for a parent, which is to tell them, don't let your child interrupt. And then I say, this isn't parenting advice. This is advice that I hope leads to less stuttering. And I can see their buy-in. So that's all. So yeah. Here's another question that I got from several different people. So now that the Franken Group in the Netherlands has data showing basic equivalence of Lidcombe and demands and capacities model treatment, should parents be given a choice accompanied by the available data? So should there be an option for two or three different treatments as opposed to just Lidcombe?
Sure. Well, in our clinic, parents are actually given a choice around the treatment when they come to the clinic. And I do understand that the paper doesn't imply this, and that was for a historical reason, was that the clinic actually started as a Lidcombe program clinic for a specific research study. And so clients had to do Lidcombe to be in the clinic. And then once that study finished, we were getting referrals from speech language pathologists in the community, and they were referring clients for Lidcombe program treatment. So it took a little while for this sort of change to take place. And we were actually surprised when one of the reviewers asked us to say what the other kids who didn't receive Lidcombe got. And we were very, very surprised to find that none of them had a different treatment, because that's certainly not the case now. But in terms of the treatments that we do offer, we primarily offer Lidcombe program and also syllable time speech, so the Westmead program, based on child and family factors that we think influence potential success with the two programs. And primarily what we're looking at here is level of perfectionism and avoidances of the child, and also if there are any major learning disabilities or autism spectrum disorders present. We tend to offer those two treatments because the clinical educators in the clinic have received training and mentoring in both, and that's not actually the case for the DCM treatment. So I personally have done some PALE and PCI training, but I haven't actually worked in the paediatric clinic since I did that training, which is unfortunate. So we use them because we have the training and the mentoring ourselves, so we feel we're able to better support the students to then use those treatments, and also because the research supports that both are capable of reducing stuttering to the extremely low level of less than 1% syllable stuttered, which I think is important if you're doing early intervention to get in and get the stuttering really low before the neural trimming starts. But that said, like the Dee Sonneville and Kodu, and I apologise if I'm saying her name incorrectly, but from the Franken Group, their trial, so the Lidcombe program versus Restart DCM trial, did show that DCM could reduce stuttering to 1.5% SS, and they mention around less than 1%, but they don't actually report those results per se, so it's a little bit harder to judge with that. But certainly we do offer a choice of treatments, and we would be open to potentially offering DCM if we had training in it and felt that we could support students to do that adequately.
So there's a lot on the table here, and I am no expert in the Westmead program, but what I think is that one of the things that one does in the Westmead program is to teach children to slow down, whereas in DCM treatment, it's the parent and the clinician who are speaking with a slower rate without telling a child, you need to slow down. Is that a fair way to just compare the two treatments?
No, the Westmead program, you don't teach a child to slow down. You teach them to talk in syllable time speech, which I'm not brilliant at actually modelling. But it is talking a bit like this so that you don't change your syllable length. So you talk like this for a little bit, and the parent models it and the clinician models it, and the child uses it, but they're not forced to use it. They're just encouraged to use it. And we find that you get that the child is then, they practice speaking like that. It prevents the stutter from occurring while they're speaking like that. But with young kids, finding you're getting carryover to non-syllable time speech. So that the when they speak in their normal speech, they're also more fluent. And so sometimes for some kids who need a little bit more of a boost, so LIC and program isn't sufficient for them, that can be just sort of triggers the system to be able to speak more fluently. So yes, it is something that the child, it's a direct therapy in that the child is being taught a new way of speaking, but it's not a way of speaking that we would expect them to use outside of the practice sessions.
So it's a little similar to what some listeners will know as fluency shaping here in the United States. So when I had Dr. Franken and Ms. DeSunneville on air, I think she might be Dr. DeSunneville now.
Yep.
One of the things that they shared was that they saw a trend in their data. And what they were saying was it looked like children who stuttered more severely might do better with DCM treatment, and children who started off stuttering perhaps less severely might do well with Lidcombe. Would you think that would be a reason to start to bring in some DCM treatment in your clinic, or do you have a different view on it?
I would say perhaps maybe that's to do with the level of expertise of their clinicians in the two programs. So if you look at the two programs and who they had doing the treatment, that on average the clinicians had five times as many years experience with DCM than they did with Lidcombe. So I would suspect that perhaps that level of expertise actually helps with the more severe kids. So for the more severe kids who need perhaps they need longer potentially in therapy, well, at least in Lidcombe they do, they would potentially then need more work around perhaps changing the therapy slightly, or at least motivation to continue with the therapy, that the more expert the clinician is in the actual program, then the better success they would have with that. So whether it is the program per se, or as you asked previously about whether it is around the expertise of the clinicians, I think it would be interesting to see if someone who, say, like me, who has a lot more experience with Lidcombe and basically no experience with DCM, if I got a little bit of experience and then did that study, if we would find that the results were reversed, or if it is the case that because that program looks at a lot of different potential factors that can influence the stutter, whether that is what's needed for a more severe child or not. I think that sometimes the more severe kids can need an extra more, I would say a more direct boost. So they would, we find that they may need some syllable time speech or some fluency shaping is what we usually add in if they've gone on for a long time and then they've started to plateau. So that potentially.
And I can't speak for the Franken group, certainly, but when I interviewed them, I asked them, because one of the criticisms one hears about their work from, I've only heard it from a few people, but I have heard a few people suggest that they didn't do Lidcombe correctly, and they seemed very confident that their group was trained well in Lidcombe, which is really related to what I want to ask you a little bit about your study too, which is, have you faced that same criticism? Have folks suggested to you that your students just aren't trained well enough in Lidcombe, which of course gets back to that initial question, which is, do you have to be an expert therapist to do Lidcombe? I'm sorry, I know I put a lot on the table there, but.
Well, I guess in terms of with the studies like the O'Brien study, suggesting that the best outcomes are from clinicians who have received the official training in LICM program. It's not possible for students to receive that training here in Australia, at least. So they are needing to be trained through the lectures that I give, through the case studies that they do, through the clinic, and therefore by their clinical educator. So they haven't done the formal training, I guess. I think possibly in terms of now with the new LICM program clinician's guide, it does spell out in a lot more detail what is expected in the treatment, how to problem solve it. And it spells out the practical delivery of the program in a way that previous manuals didn't. And during the time that the audit was conducted was during the time of those previous manuals didn't have that degree of detail in them. And so then they only had that old version of the manual and the text, the LICM program text, and their lecture notes to learn from, and then obviously their clinical educator to ask for pointers and provide feedback as well. So certainly, yes, they do have different training to what a clinician can get in terms of getting formal training. So there is a potential there that I hope they're not poorly trained in it, because that's my job is to train them. But in terms of in the lectures and everything, they're getting an overview of many different programs. It's not like we only teach LICM. So they are having to take that information, and then on clinic they are learning more about LICM while they're in the clinic environment.
This is Stutter Talk. I'm Peter Reitzis here with Dr. Michelle Swift, who's joining us from Australia, where she is at Flinders University. And I've got so many things to ask you, and I can't ask them all at once, but I guess there are worse problems to have, right?
Sure.
So I'm not asking you for names or anything, but has anyone reached out to you and said, hey, we really don't like this 57%. This doesn't look good. Can we help you in some way to get that down? Because I assume it's been a bit of a buzz in Australia too.
Well, nobody's actually contacted me about that, and that's why I was surprised when you contacted me to talk today. I haven't heard much. I did present the findings, early version of these findings, a few years ago at a stuttering symposium that was held here, and at the time people were curious around the fact that it took longer and that not everyone was completing, and they were keen to have a look at their own student clinics to see if there were similar findings in their clinics, which would be interesting because all the clinics are set up differently. So if it was a structural issue, then potentially that would come up, whether it was structural or whether it was to do with the level of experience of the students, because in a lot of the other clinics they have more senior students than we do in ours. But no, I haven't had anybody directly contact me to discuss what we might be able to do to reduce that dropout rate.
I give you a lot of credit for doing this work and publishing it, because I don't think there's an equivalent with DCM treatment. And I know that the people who are doing DCM and related treatments are really trying to publish more and more, because you LIDCOM folks are hard to keep up with. So here's something that I definitely want to ask you. So if a researcher were to audit, now I know you don't have a crystal ball, but I'm still going to ask you.
Sure.
If a researcher were to audit case files of graduate students using DCM treatment, can you speculate about what you might find? And before we went on air, I heard back from somebody who works at a clinic where they do a lot of DCM, and the supervisor told me that their dropout rates are not anywhere near as high as 57%, but they also haven't published it yet. So what would you expect to find?
Well, I think in some ways it is difficult to speculate because there are a lot of variables. So it would depend on the structure of the clinic and the level of training of the clinical educator in the program, I think, and the student's exposure to the program in the pre-clinic teaching, and also the level of experience of the students in the clinic in general. I think it one thing that might result in less dropout is that in the DCM treatment, from my understanding at least, that the point at which the clients finish is the point at which the family and the clinicians are happy with the level of progress. So there's not this very, very strict criteria that they have to meet like they do in LIDCM. So certainly if you were negotiating that, and if you knew there was about to be a break of 6 weeks, and if the family was happy with the way things were going, then they might say, look, we're happy to finish now. And if the clinician is happy enough, then they say, okay. And then that would possibly be recorded as a completed treatment rather than a dropout, whereas with the LIDCM program, it's going to be recorded as a dropout because they haven't actually met the official criteria. I guess in the Dishonorable Kodut study, for the initial gains in percent SS, the DCM treatment actually took a bit longer, even though the clinicians were much more experienced in that treatment. So if we're saying that we think that the level of experience impacts treatment duration, then I would say that perhaps students administering DCM would take longer again to make initial gains. And so that may result in even more dropouts in that initial period if parents aren't seeing that same gain. But I think it's difficult to tell. I really feel that I would need to know the therapy a lot better than I do because I only really know about it theoretically. I have never used it, so it's really hard for me to make a judgment call about what factors might, like whether students would be able to do it more easily. But I think that some of that structural stuff is important, and around what the actual criteria and what you count as a dropout or not would impact on that as well.
And I'm glad that you're saying her name correctly because I said it wrong. You're right. It's Dishonorable Kodut, and I was just saying Dishonorable. So, and we're talking about the Franken group. So I'm glad you got it right there. And I'm going to mention that I think you have a good point there about perhaps the final outcomes. There might be slightly different standards to for exiting from DCM and LIDCM, because I do know some folks who practice DCM types of treatments where they might not be expecting the exact low percentage of syllable stutter that you are. But I also tell you, in my own private practice, I do an integrated approach of operant conditioning and DCM. And my preschoolers, when they exit, the families are looking for zero stuttering or almost no stuttering. And so the two children I just told you about who were recently exited, those families exited after 11 sessions after the child had been stuttering very, very little or not at all for a month or two. And that's what, just to be very blunt, like that's like families are looking for no stuttering with young children. So a couple more questions. Do you have time for a few more questions?
Yes, sure. That's fine.
One professor shared with Stutter Talk their experience that students just do not easily make the switch from classroom discussion of the potential causes of stuttering and the effectiveness of Lidcombe. They find a theoretical and practical disconnect. Do you see this at all?
I think it depends very much on the student. Some students do find that connection a bit harder to make than others, but not all students find that difficult. I think that we do work very hard with the students to build their clinical reasoning and to make sure that they are explicitly stating their rationales for doing everything and for every component of the treatment that they do, that they can explain why it is that they're doing it, and we don't accept because it's in the guide as a good reason. They need to be able to actually explain to us what they are expecting to achieve, how it relates to the client's goals. So I think some students do find it harder, but I would say the majority don't find it too difficult, at least after the first few weeks and with some guidance from their clinical educator. And as I said earlier, I think that the new Lidcombe Programs Clinician Guide actually makes it easier for students to make that connection because it's spells out the program in a lot more detail. But I think one of sometimes the misconception about Lidcombe program is that it's a manualised program and it's exactly the same for every single child that walks through the door. And that's not actually the case, that it is never delivered in the same way for every client. So students and clinicians, when they use it, need to be making individualizations for the client that's in front of them. So the way that the contingencies are provided and which ones are used would be individualized, the activities that the parent and child do together, and also the way that the parent structures the conversation to reduce the amount of stuttering, all things that are very much individualized for the parent and the child. So the student really does need to have a good understanding of what they're doing and why they're doing it. So certainly for some of the students who are a little bit weaker in terms of their clinical reasoning and are finding those connections harder, then they are going to have probably less success and take longer to get parents through than the student who is able to make those connections more readily. But I'd say the majority of students can make those connections, but certainly they probably do take a little bit longer to make them at times because their clinical reasoning is still developing as part of their training.
Yeah, I don't really hear a concern that it's too manualized. I mean, I have heard it, but I don't really hear it anymore because I think most of the people I talk to on this issue, or those who are familiar with Lidcombe, they understand that it is very individualized within its use. I think the greater concern I hear, and I hear it a lot, is that why don't some of the people who promote Lidcombe also promote other treatments? The thought being not all treatments work for all people. And I know a lot of people, including myself, who integrate, who use two different treatments or more. So there is thought of, well, why? We get the sense that there's some resistance from those who practice Lidcombe of integrating other treatments or using different treatments. So that's the big complaint I hear, is why aren't they also open to other treatments? I don't know if you hear that too.
Sure. Yes, definitely. And I think that it potentially is around, there's two different things that you brought up there. One is the integration of treatment, and the other one is around being willing to look more broadly than just one treatment. I think in terms of the integration of treatment, with integrating treatment, need to be very clear on what the client and the clinician factors are that have led you to make that decision to integrate the treatment, because as soon as you integrate two treatments together, then you're not doing either treatment in the way that it's been researched. And so needing to make sure that you have very good reasons, a very good rationale in terms of client factors or in terms of your service delivery or what can be offered for integrating them, so that you're still practicing evidence-based practice using those three components of evidence. And so I guess that is we get a lot here, people who say they use LICM, but it is very, very different from the way LICM program was developed and due to mainly service delivery issues, and that the what that means in terms of client outcomes is not so clear. So there is, I guess, a bit of a feeling if you're going to say you're going to do LICM, then you do LICM as it's been researched. However, that said, there may be good reasons for modifying it, and people have always added extra bits and pieces in if the children are not progressing through the treatment just using the standard thing. And I think that's good clinical reasoning, but you need to have a good clinical reason for doing it and not just do it because you've always do it. And for the same reason, you need to have a good clinical reason for actually doing the program as it's manualized and not making changes if the client isn't progressing through. So I think you need to have the two versions. I'm actually someone who doesn't believe that there is one best treatment for preschool stuttering. I think if you want to ask that question, then you'd need to also ask for which client in which context is it the best treatment. So I think that there does need to be openness to a potential range of treatments. I think what there does need to be is a good solid research evidence for all the potential treatments that people are using, and that people aren't just using things because they always have done it, and that goes either way. It goes indirect, it goes to LICM, it goes to various things that people have. There's a good solid research evidence behind that treatment. That would be where I always start and why I normally do look at LICM first, because it has the most research evidence. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the best, it just means it has the most. And then look, okay, are there clinician or client factors that mean that this isn't the best treatment? And if it's not going to be the best treatment for this client, what other treatments are out there that have some research to support them? And do I have the training and the skills to be able to deliver them? So, yes, but I certainly think that there has been, I think it's unfortunate personally that there has seemed to be a divide into two very strong camps, which are those people who say LICM is the only treatment and you should not do anything else, and those people who say that if you even talk about LICM, then you're selling your clients short. And I think that it's and I have been in the middle of both camps, and it's not a very pleasant place to be, and I don't think it's really the nicest, the best environment for really building up treatments for the best outcomes for our clients. I think we really need to be looking at all our clients, and rather than fighting treatments against each other, really looking at the client before us and what treatment we think would best suit that client, and hopefully building up enough research evidence for the less researched treatments to show that they can have success as well.
Yeah, there's a lot on the table there, but in line with how you just ended there, I was really glad to see you cite Nan Bernstein-Ratner, who you cited her in a way that just supported this idea of doing what's best for the client in front of you. And I know we both agree on that. This is Stutter Talk. Peter writes this with Dr. Michelle Swift. And just one or two last things. You put a lot on the table there, so I'm just going to share with you that I just presented a case study to my district where I brought in a dad I worked with his daughter who stutters, and she was a preschooler. And after 11 sessions, we exited, and he came in to present with me to my district right at the end. And we presented on an integrated treatment, and it was operant conditioning treatment and DCM treatment. As you notice, I didn't say LIDCOM because it's easier just to say operant conditioning, because I know that the LIDCOM folks don't like it if you say LIDCOM-like. And So we presented and he was very happy with the treatment. And I pointed out to my colleagues, well, this is a real success story, but you're not going to find a research study pointing to the type of treatment I did. But what you will find is a lot of speech language pathologists who do this work similarly. So I do think we need to start to do research on these integrated treatments. And one other point I'll make, and I hope it's just fun, is that when I lived in New York in Brooklyn, my wife and I went to Coney Island one day, and we sort of were in that area where Coney Island meets Brighton Beach. And we walked into a restaurant and had one of the best meals of our life. And it wasn't Chinese and it wasn't Russian, but it was some mix of the two. And it was the most amazing food I ever had. So that integrated food, I really appreciate it. So I just wanted to share that with you. I've got two last questions for you. One clinical supervisor of students shared this with Stutter Talk. As a supervising speech pathologist, I most certainly ensure that recommendations are appropriate to the clients. If one particular strategy doesn't appear to be effective, we draw on another, direct, indirect, and a combination of both, whatever is sensible for our clients, ensuring a broad-based and family-centered approach. So do you think the dropout rate would have been lower if students were trained to use and integrate, when appropriate, several different preschool stuttering treatments? So if the students had the ability to choose an alternate treatment or to integrate treatments, do you think the dropout rate might have been lower?
Well, I think for this particular study, we were benchmarking clients who'd received LICM program as it is in the clinician's guide. So those clients actually would have still been included in the dropout rate because they would have received a different treatment. So in terms of that, but in terms of whether we would have counted them in the audit in the first place, I guess, is whether they would have been not counted as having received LICM, so they would have been in a different group of clients, then perhaps you might have seen a slightly lower dropout rate for LICM only kids. I guess as I mentioned earlier, that at the time of the audit, the LICM program was the main treatment used in the clinic, and there was a small time at the very beginning where the clients had to receive LICM because of another research study that they were being involved in. So it is possible that some of those ones that we would have potentially have changed with those clients if either the clinician didn't think it was the suitable treatment for them, or if the clients didn't want to continue with LICM, then they weren't able to continue in the clinic. So then they would have counted a small amount towards that dropout rate that we have. But we do use a combination of treatment and approaches when required, and we are currently in the process of getting ethics approval to audit our clinic over the previous 4 years from now, which is when we have used a wider range of treatments for preschoolers who stutter. So it will be interesting to see if there's actually any change in the dropout rate over that period where clients have received a bit more of a combination. As we do always try and make sure that our treatment is family-centred, that we are using the treatments that the client is benefiting from, although, as I said, we most often do use LICM program and Westmead type approaches. That said, occasionally we are having trouble with structuring of the conversation, those sort of things, then we might include some indirect approaches at that point, and that then is not strictly LICM, but it can sometimes help with actually getting that fluent speech during that practice session to incorporate some of those. So I guess that would then be integrated treatment. So I think it will be interesting to see over the last 4 years whether the dropout rates changed at all with the different range of treatments that are there that potentially are a little bit more individualised to the clients. And I guess if we don't see any change to the dropout rate, then maybe it's structural aspects of the clinic that are just that they're not really very changeable in terms of how many times the students change the roster, how big the gaps are between the semesters and those sort of things.
So we're discussing your study, case file audit of Lidcombe Program Outcomes in a Student-Led Stuttering Clinic, published in the International Journal of Speech Language Pathology. And here's the last question for you, Dr. Michelle Swift. Are you going to change anything in the clinic because of your study? Like, for example, will there be better training or different training or checking the students' allegiance to the philosophy of Lidcombe? Are you going to implement any changes?
Well, I think the thing that we have implemented is around sort of counselling families as to the fact that we know that the treatment does take a longer duration if they do Lidcombe in a student clinic, and what the implications of that might be in terms of costs, so financial, but also all the other costs that come to doing a treatment weekly and with daily practice, and ongoing motivation and continuity of service, and also around what it might mean to discontinue treatment without completing it. So when we're talking about the options of the different treatments that are available to them, being very upfront around what we found in terms of the increased duration. And so we would also continue to offer alternative treatments like we do currently. And in terms of the structure of the clinic is very difficult for us to change because it's at a program level or a course level around the way that the students are rostered in. And I think that I'm not sure that it is so much the student level of training, although that would be something to look into. I think that it's more around where they are in their clinical journey, and so certainly adding in maybe some group, but they already do group feedback and group tutorials, but making sure that those are done consistently, because sometimes they fall away when the clinic gets busy, so the tutorials sometimes fall out of that clinic time, making sure that those are always in there, the group problem solving with the students and the clinical educators. And we already have a lot of checks of session plans and of rationales and reasoning, but making sure that those things continue to happen, and I guess as well making sure that students are identifying clients who are maybe not progressing, not showing change, that they make sure they identify them early and get support rather than just doing the same thing week on, week out. And I guess that's one of the things that sometimes students do, especially in their early rosters, is they just do the same thing because they're comfortable doing that, and to really making sure that we are on top of that and making sure that the students aren't just planning exactly the same session 2 weeks in a row, but they're making changes to, in order to progress the families through.
And I think some seasoned speech language pathologists might fall into that trap too. So I really promise that this is the last question, but this just popped into my head. It seems that if you were to repeat this study, and if you were to be pretty confident that one of the main problems with student-led Lidcombe is that the switching of the therapist, then that could be a tough spot, because we want to train our graduate students to work with families of children who stutter. But if the evidence points to student clinicians not doing the best job, then that might suggest to the field that there has to be a different way to train students. Is that a concern that our research might point us away from allowing students to work with children who stutter?
I think that would be a big problem if that was what the research was supporting, because there is evidence from other research that students, once they graduate, that people are only confident to work with stuttering if they have had meaningful clinical experience as students in the area. And certainly that's an issue that we have had here, that a lot of people in the field aren't confident to work in stuttering, and that has led to policies that mean that stuttering isn't actually treated in the public sector here after the age of four. So that's actually after the child turns four. So a child older than three would not be eligible for a public service for stuttering where I'm currently located, which obviously creates a huge amount of problems. And so I think I would be I would hope that we would be able to maybe look at a way perhaps that there are certain programs, or that maybe looking at whether we could modify the programs in certain ways that would enable them to be able to be delivered by students in a way that doesn't require as much switching. Because I think that it is important that students have that opportunity, and it is actually part of the mandated, I don't think that's quite the right word, but to be accredited by Speech Pathology Australia as a program here, all our graduates need to have direct or high-level indirect clinical experience with people who stutter. There's an issue at that point, but I think the bigger issue is that if we don't have students do stuttering clinics, then they are not going to have any particular desire to work in that area, and then we find that the policies that are made and the advocacy of the profession start to move away from stuttering as an important area and focus on other areas, and then we can find that we don't have any services.
It's really a catch-22, and I'm just free thinking here. It's just I kind of think of my own children, and if I was taking them for stuttering treatment, would I want them to go to a student or to a to a seasoned professional? Well, of course I would want the seasoned professional. And and I think your research, I think, is very brave, and I really commend you for doing it. It just has me thinking, with such a high dropout rate, it is a concern. But I'm repeating myself now.
Yeah, well, I think what we found, though, was that students were able to make the same gains. So it's not like they weren't able to actually make the gains. They took longer and there was a higher dropout rate. So, and to really counselling families, and that's what we were looking at, what can we tell families that they're going to get the same outcomes? And I would say that we can tell them that there is the potential for the same outcomes, but it will take longer, and that there is going to be potentially changes in clinicians, and that may impact on their continuity of service, and that will impact on how long it takes as well, and that they may or may not choose to start the treatment with that knowledge. I think we've got a bit of an issue here as well, in that clients don't have a lot of choice of treatment. So if they don't come to the student clinic, then they're going to see a private therapist. The costs are much higher for that, although they might be there for a shorter period of time, so they need to work that out. And it's sort of, they either get nothing or they get the student clinic. And is it better than nothing? Well, that's something we need to talk to them about, in terms of whether part treatment is better than no treatment at this very young age. Now, certainly for an older age group, I would argue that possibly not. But if you can reduce stuttering by half after 11 sessions or so, but it's not technically complete, but it's still down to 2% SS, is that better than not starting at all?
So. Yeah. And we have different problems here. Like, for example, I'm the only speech therapist I know in the schools who treats preschool stuttering by having a family come in, by doing the therapy, by training the parents. So there are great mountains to climb here and in Australia. And I'm just going to remind the listeners that you did point out that four of the families withdrew from the study because they were pleased. And I think that's an important thing that we have to remember. So Dr. Michelle Swift, you've been so generous with your time, and I just really want to thank you for coming on Stutter Talk.
That's okay. Thanks for having me.